I'm going to talk today about computer simulations. The good, the bad, and the awful. How predictions are made using a computer. I'm going to read this and then try to ad-lib the rest. The reading is so that you all can get used to my rather strange southern accent. Excellent computer simulations are done for a purpose. The most valid purposes are to explore uncharted territory, resolve a well-posed scientific or technical question, or to make a design choice. Often one gets useful results from incompletely resolved situations or from computer programs of unknown accuracy. Programs such as this might suggest novel physical mechanisms and behaviors and thus serve as starting points for larger technical investigations. Of course, this kind of work and all kinds of work with a computer needs a full integration of the modeling effort into a scientific or an engineering program. Some excellent work, much of it done at the U.S. Department of Energy labs, is reviewed. Some less happy stories, often from the same sources, are recounted. An example of a supernova calculation is traced in detail. That's the published version in Computers in Science and Engineering. I'm a theoretical physicist and mathematician. I work in part for a program called ASCII Flash. I should tell you a little bit of about the politics of ASCII, now called ASC rather than ASCII. It was when the United States decided that it wanted to take part in the treaty banning the testing of nuclear weapons, the Department of Energy laboratories wanted to have something to do with themselves, so that they demanded and obtained a program of large-scale computational simulations in order to serve as a device for understanding how our nuclear weapons would age and understanding how to keep that nuclear stockpile in acceptable shape. That program is called the Stockpile Stewardship Program. In part, the work went out to university communities who were going to use computer simulations to solve their own kinds of problems and to serve as parallel examples to the use of the large-scale computers in the Department of Energy facilities. My own role in all of this is that I work for a University of Chicago program called ASCII Flash. Flash describes the thermonuclear explosions occurring in as supernova or nova that we study and simulate on the computer. I'm not a large-scale simulator. I do lots of small-scale simulations, but I hang around with the group, watch what they're doing, try to explain what they've accomplished, and try to offer criticism when it's useful. Partially, this talk is a result, an outcome of this kind of work. I'm going to start out by describing the very best in computer simulations sort of ever done. These are at the beginning, mostly at the beginning of the computer age. And then I'm going to go and talk about the worst calculations we've ever seen. And then I will go and talk about calculations being done now, which are neither the best nor the worst. Starting from the very beginning, Alan Turing is the inventor of a model of a computer, a simple theoretical model of the computer. He is, in some sense, the start of it all. He also did practical work, putting a computer to work in breaking the German World War II submarine codes. Later on, he also did first-rate work in morphogenesis. He thought out the process by which an instability could give birth to structures in the development of an embryo. He invented what is called the reaction diffusion system. He conceptualized morphogenesis as a computer which produced structures and patterns. After that, there was the computer was invented, and there was some excellent work with it. As an example of that excellent work, I reached Alder, Bernie Alder, who is still working at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, one of the nuclear labs, and Wainwright. Bernie Alder and his collaborator developed an amazing mastery of the technique of simulating on a computer the motion of molecules through space. In addition to their computational technique, they made some wonderful discoveries. One of those discoveries was that they could follow the molecules in a two-dimensional hard sphere system, two-dimensional spheres which bounced off of one another, and see as they followed the motion of those molecules that there was a phase transition from a gaseous or liquid state to a ordered solid state. That phase transition was first discovered on a computer and has since been seen experimentally. The second surprising work that they did was that these hard spheres, and indeed any molecules moving in a gas, produced long-range correlations. What would happen is that one molecule would move through the gas, push the other molecules out of the way, and a long wake was produced behind them. These long-range correlations were of hydrodynamic in character and surprised everyone. Another example of a great calculation was a simulation done by my colleague Tom Witten and his colleague Len Sander at the University of Michigan. They invented an algorithm called DLA, standing for diffusion limited aggregation, which produced fractal objects. If in case you don't know what a fractal object is, it is one in which there are all length scales represented. Inside of this would be another thing like that, this, and inside of that, another and another. But why don't I show you a picture of a fractal object produced by their algorithm, and then I can tell you how the algorithm worked. Here is a fractal object produced by their algorithm, but I'll come back to it and first tell you how the algorithm works. I have to get this right side up, or don't have to, but people laugh less if I do. Okay. It is the world's simplest thing. You take a lattice, and you imagine that on the lattice there's a bunch of particles sitting there, which you call the aggregate. What you have in mind is a group of particles of soot all stuck together and sitting there in the atmosphere. Another small particle comes along from far away and goes through a random walk, walking in all directions until it comes and sits, it becomes to be a nearest neighbor of the aggregate. It then clamps onto the aggregate, sits still, and the process starts all over again with some other walker coming in from far away and coming up close to the aggregate. It grows and grows and produces an object like the one I flashed in front of you a moment ago and will bring back now. Here's the aggregate. What we have is particles which rain down from the top. They're reflected at these walls, and they stick at the bottom. At the beginning, a few small trees grow up. You can see these trees dwarfed in their growth down here. After a while, one tree gets ahead of the others and grows large and tall, producing branches which have a fractal structure, and the whole thing is fractal in character. This was the first time, as far as I know, that a computer algorithm was used to define an object in physics. There are lots of other examples I could give you to describe great stuff. But I'm going to go on and describe stuff which is only, instead of being classically great like Plato, is only great like modern playwright, Pinter, or somebody. One piece of computer work that I want to particularly point to is in part of a program by Ray Davis and John Bacall. The late John Bacall was a classmate of mine, so I find it pleasing to talk about his work. Experimenters catch and caught neutrinos from the sun. Solar models predict the neutrino production. But at the beginning, the simulation models and the observed neutrinos had a different flux. The simulation gave a higher flux than the experiments gave. Was the simulation right? The model was checked and checked upwards and backwards. The model involved the dynamical processes, the nuclear reactions that go on in the sun, so it has lots of difficult things. You had to calculate the nuclear reactions right. You had to get the motion within the sun right. However, after many, many checks of the different things, people believed that the model was valid. Therefore, people in the field began to believe that there was a real disagreement between theory and observations. Eventually, something had to give, and eventually what gave was the theory. Theorists began to predict is a funny word. Theorists began to admit that neutrinos had a mass, and that the mass of the neutrinos could produce oscillations with distance in the number of observed neutrinos of a given kind, and that kind of neutrino is observed on the Earth, and that could explain the discrepancy between the computer simulation and the observation. There was another measurement. A seismographic measurement showed the oscillations in the sun and completely showed that the model of the sun was right and was giving the right answers. This is a real triumph for all of science, and particularly it is a triumph, and among other parts of science, it is a triumph for computer simulation. Simulators have explored the early history of the universe. Gravity produces instabilities, which produces fractal structures in the universe. Simulators follow these events. For example, the pictures I'm about to show in a moment come from Andrei Kravtsov at Chicago. Theory, experiment, and simulations explore the phenomena. Now, the theorists had an amazingly hopeful view of what they could do. Amazingly ambitious. They said they could, by looking at what was going on, see whether the models that they were using were right. The models had lots of parameters in them, but by seeing what agreed with what we observe about the universe, they could then get down to one and hopefully the fully correct model of the universe. I'm not sure that whether I'm quite dubious as to whether that program can succeed. I think that the nature has too many possibilities, and you can't explore the whole range of possibilities with a computer. But nonetheless, the computer programs produce wonderful stuff. There you start out with particles sort of uniformly spread out over what is this box is for the computer simulator, the entire universe. These particles attract one another by gravity, and the attraction makes the particles clump up. After lots of clumping and lots of computer simulations, you get out a picture which looks like that, which represents the universe at our present day. There is clumping of matter, as you can see, and that a clumping occurs at all scales. That is a kind of fractal behavior. that fractal behavior is, Horace, what did I do? I'm missing a picture. Okay, that, oh no, it just got out of order just slightly. That fractal behavior is very much like the fractal behavior that is actually observed in the universe in, for example, this picture by Margaret Geller and Hutra from 1989. Similar pictures are known today, and you can see that there is lots of clumping of galaxies in the universe. On goes the work. People are doing more and more sophisticated calculations. Their sophistication and my doubtfulness are both represented by the fact that the simulations now are of dark matter, matter which exists quite clearly in the minds of the theorist, but has never been seen in the eyes of the observer. These simulations then predict the motion of stuff which has not yet been observed in order to deduce the one and only correct theory of the universe. Okay, now we bounce for the best stuff that's ever been done to the absolute worst stuff. I could not, for my very worst example, choose something which is 100% true. This may only be legends told over cups of coffee in the homes of, in the coffee shops around the universities of computer simulators. But according to the legend, once upon a time, Great Britain wanted to construct a transportation investment model. The goal was to get the best transportation system while minimizing public spending. Their broad mix of roads, rails, public improvements were included. Overall maximization or minimizations was obtained, expressing all the quantities in the model in pounds sterling and adjusting all the parameters to produce the minimum cost. The result produced detailed predictions and directions for public spending. These predictions went to a select committee. The select committee had the job of vetting the report and saying what was good and bad about it. However, they noticed several peculiar features. For example, the computer result recommended zero spending on pedestrian road crossings, zebra crossings. That's strange because the flow of pedestrian traffic is valued in the model. Nonetheless, it is a comprehensive model, and you think if the model gives an answer, it must be right. Indeed, it was right within the limitations of the model. It says there, as most of you have read, the cost of social programs are included in the minimization. Pensions are a debit. Most people killed at road crossings are old. Hence, they have a negative value. The result of maximization or minimization is now explained. Theory is needed to go with a simulation. There's a moral which goes with this. Design goals are usually multidimensional. All sensible modelers ask not only what comes out, but why did we get this outcome? Modeling efforts should include theory and especially common sense. This case may be a myth, but apparently a less mythical example concerned an American cigarette, U.S. cigarette company and the Czech government. The government was advised to support cigarette advertising since the early deaths the cigarette advertising would produce would have a beneficial effect on pension spending. Nature following art. We progress to single bubble sonoluminescence. Since I seem to have bobbled the words, I will put up a picture instead. What you do is you take a container. On the outside of the container, you add things which produce sound, which are focused towards the center of the container. The sound produces a bubble which expands and contracts with the waves of sound. When that bubble starts to expand and contract, producing a hole, that hole becomes luminous and light comes out. So sound has been turned into light. This is a fact. This happens. Question is to explain it. There's a concentration of energy. Higher temperatures, 10,000 or 100,000 degrees, are produced, and light comes off. This effect was discovered, of course, by experimentalists. Theory, experiment, and simulations all work to explore the phenomenon. The progress was slowed by the complexity of the problem. It involves fluid mechanics, some of the chemistry of what goes on inside the bubble. There's a huge some of the possible ranges of physics. There's a huge space of possibilities being explored. There are experiments to measure the length of the light pulse and good initial work. However, the work got into trouble. Early workers in the field seemed to have gotten confused or misled, perhaps by their enthusiasm for novel sources of energy. If this were not 10,000 or 100,000 degrees, but 10 million degrees, you could have fusion power. Early experiments noticed that the light came off in pulses. Naturally, the bubble was collapsing and collapsing and collapsing again. Pulses seemed very short. Given the measured energy fluxes, these widths suggested very high temperatures and suggested the possibility of fusion power. Early simulations backed up this possibility. The early simulators left out viscosity and got shocks at very short pulse widths. In fact, looking back, we can see that if you leave out viscosity, the shocks would have a dimension which would go to zero, and the temperature would go to infinity, only limited by the resolution of the computer. A better, that is, a more expensive computer with more data points and a more calculations would give sharper shocks, shorter pulse widths, and higher temperatures ad infinitum. So early simulations, especially the very best, led people in the wrong direction. An experimentalist named Gompf in 1997 measured the pulse width correctly. After that, the simulators got better results. For a summary, see this paper in Reviews of Modern Physics. Now, I've simplified the story somewhat. If you look at the most moderately recent paper in Nature, you'll see that there were short pulses, that they didn't contain the majority of the energy, but you could get short pulses, and there were two temperatures of the thing and a more complex story than I told. Nonetheless, it was certainly true that the simulations, which gave all the energy coming off at a very short pulse, were misleading people and pushing them in the wrong direction. Eventually, things got straightened out. An experiment conducted at the U.S. Department of Energy Oak Ridge Laboratory suggested that fusion was occurring in a system involving resonant absorption of sound in deuterated acetone. Something about producing energy in a producing very small, very high temperatures in a very small box attracted people, especially people connected with the U.S. Department of Energy. The paper, published in Science, involved both experimental work and computer simulations. I quote from the paper, "A roughly tenfold increase in the external driving pressure was used in the calculations beyond the pressure directly produced by the experimental situation, approximately accounts for the effect of pressure intensification within the imploding bubble clusters. As a result, simulation supported the experimental data, supported the observed data. The approximately tenfold increase in the external driving factor is, in your and my language, known as a fudge factor, stuck in to agree with the data. One might ask what kind of quality control is appropriate for a computer calculation used to check a provocative experimental result. Apparently, computer calculations require very little quality control, especially when the paper seems exciting and provocative to the editor, here Donald Kennedy of Science. A desire for exciting results can lead people to publish computer calculations containing a completely uncontrolled calculation. My moral is that a program of modeling should either elucidate new processes or identify wrong directions. Otherwise, there's no point in carrying it out. In many examples concerned with novel mechanisms for the concentration of energy, the simulations were quite pointless and played a somewhat negative role in the advance of the field. It appears that the simulations were performed to support a desired result rather than ask what is true. In fact, one does not often see computer simulations which get a result which was very different from those that the simulators started out wanting. You all will tell me about some of them that don't agree with that rule. Here's another example of a nice computer simulation, just to get our minds off the bad stuff. One is making a nanojet on the computer. Here is computer gold and a computer pentane. I'm sorry, I've forgotten what the molecules are here. But in any case, these are computer stuff put together to do a calculation using classical mechanics of the orbits of all the different particles, which you can see here. The object being tested here is a possible nanojet produced by shoving this gas through the nozzle. The computer simulation shows the jet coming out and forming and forming. The thing to measure is the pressure had needed in order to cause this effect. Indeed, the simulations show that the pressure head needed is somewhat more than is available technically at the moment, and this is a somewhat disappointing result for the technology to be used, but it's close, and maybe someday it will be. So here's a good example of an integrative simulation used to approach an important engineering question. However, there's also another feature of this simulation that I wish to point to you. It also had the virtue of having a surprising result. Here is the nozzle way back here. Time goes this way. And this is a picture of the jet coming out at the earliest time and the latest time. Now, a group of us at Chicago, myself included, work on the formation of necks and the separation of drops from a main body of fluid. We are, you might say, experts at the shapes of these necks formed at the point of separation. The important thing about these necks is that they are nothing like the ones we observe in our experiments on ordinary fluids. I say our experiments. That's, of course, no one would let me in the lab. This is Sid Nagel's experiment and shows what a drop of this kind looks like. The theory says that this shape is robust, universal, doesn't change under small perturbations in the fluids or the external conditions or anything. Here is a picture, a time development of a similar kind of thing with, as you can see, a neck form as the drop comes down in this frame. These drops are, as I say, entirely different in shape. In the Nagel picture, the drop is asymmetrical. A skinny thing comes and joins a fat thing. Here, it's symmetrical. There are other important differences. After a while, theory was developed, in fact, by these same authors, Mosla and Landman. And these authors develop a theory which says it's the fluctuations caused by the fact that there are individual molecules in the simulation which make the difference between this and this. Yes, this is universal, but it doesn't hold down to the molecular scale. If you had things in which molecular fluctuations were important, you wouldn't see the same shape. Another example. Now I'm not going to answer. I'm not going to try to load questions up too much in terms of quality. I've done that up until now. Now, since I'm talking about work which is moderately close to my own, I play a sort of minor role in it, I'm going to give you the facts with some slanting from tone of voice, but I'll try not to be too tremendously slanting. Okay, Rayleigh-Taylor instability occurs when a high-density fluid sits on top of a low-density fluid. The high-density fluid naturally wants to go down, or if the fluids are being accelerated to replace the gravity, a similar thing happens. And as the high-density fluid goes down, it forms necks and drops and very substantially penetrates the lower fluid. The conventional wisdom is a formula which says that the penetration depth of the high-density fluid into the low-density fluid is a constant times Atwood's number, which is the dimensionless version of the difference in densities, times the acceleration of gravity, and grows as time squared. This constant is important because it's important in understanding how you might design real things which might occur in such a situation. For example, it is important in understanding how material is blown off of an exploding star. The Department of Energy feels that this thing is important and has arranged for, now it's about 15 groups doing separate, 15 papers which have measured or calculated alpha. The theory suggests that alpha should be universal. Now, I could go through a whole song and dance about universal. Universal is a word used to mean that alpha shouldn't depend much on conditions that are around it. In fact, it might be completely independent of conditions. The embarrassing result is that it does not appear to be universal from the calculation, from the simulations or the experiments, but let me show you some pictures. Here is a simulation by a large group, but in part the University of Chicago, which shows the penetration of one fluid into another. This calculation is done by conventional fluid mechanics methodologies with zero viscosity and zero surface tension. This calculation was done by a group at Los Alamos and Livermore National Laboratories, uses the kinds of molecular dynamics techniques of individual particles bouncing around. There are 1.3 times 10 to the 8th particles, and you can see the drip of heavy fluid into the light fluid rather clearly in this picture. There have been experiments with guns shooting things up in the air to produce the appropriate acceleration. And now there are results. I'm worried for a second about results, but I can live with. Ah, here's my picture of results. So, each dot on the left-hand side of the picture represents a simulation. On the bottom, you have a scale. This simulation had 3 × 10⁷ calculational zones, places where you measured the velocity or density. This is down to 10⁴ calculational zones. A lot of calculations have been done. And this then measures the number of zones. Here is a measure of alpha. Using the formula with t squared, they inferred a value of alpha. And here are the inferred values of alpha, ranging from 0.02 up to 0.085. The experiments are slightly more tightly clustered. Here is a number of observations, and here are the results. Here is a histogram of the number of alpha values the number of alpha values plotted against alpha again. The only thing you could say from this picture is, at least in my reading of the picture, is that alpha is to a factor of 2 uncertain. The original assumption, okay, I have a big log sorga dance about this, which says you can, as some people want to, take one set of measurements and use the large value of alpha. You can choose another bunch of friends and choose the smaller values of alpha. Either of these results would be good for the existing calculational methods, which I infer reach remarkable levels of detail and complexity by using zero viscosity and zero surface tension codes. Logically, there is a third possibility. The results for low viscosity and surface tension are quite unstable, and the computer output depends in details upon details put in by the code designer rather than by nature. If you've been using a code with a given value of alpha for 25 years, you do not like this outcome. I claim that the measurements support what I am touting, and here is a picture which supports that point of view, produced by my colleagues at the University of Chicago, particularly Alan Calder. This is a picture of penetration from a fluid from above into a fluid from below. The penetration is given in these different pictures because the different pictures have different resolutions, different numbers of calculational stations as you go across in this direction. 8 here, 4 there, 2048 there. Similar density of calculational stations as you go up. These are snapshots at a given time after the fluids are released. You can see that these pictures are different. In fact, they are different in many ways. They are not monotone. They involve symmetry in the lower values of the resolution and a loss of left-right symmetry in the higher values. They are an indication that something big is happening here. And if you do simulations around there, or worse, well, around there, it's no worse, you won't see this new thing that happens. Why is this calculational resolution so important? Well, there's an explanation. Problems with an interface and no surface tension are said to be ill-posed. That's mathematical jargon, which says the problems don't make any sense. In such problems, it's often true that tiny changes in initial conditions or boundary conditions or calculational method can give very substantial variations in the answer. As, for example, resolution is made finer, the calculational results might not converge or might converge to the wrong answer or might even converge smoothly to the correct answer. All three possibilities occur in different ill-posed problems. This is an ill-posed problem, as has been known to be so for ages. So what does one say when one takes a group of people and looks at their calculation of a hot bubble rising from the center of the galaxy in a zero viscosity, zero surface tension code? Here's the picture. It's very handsome. It was published in Nature. To be fair to Science Magazine, which I mentioned earlier, I should mention Nature and tell you that this particular calculation, neither in its details nor in its gross features, has any correspondence with Nature. I started up. Okay, I'm going to talk about, thank you. We just got around to the other side of the star and sort in the wrong direction. I'm going to talk about nova and supernova events, or rather I'm going to decide in the next 30 seconds whether I'm going to talk about both. Both are formed when a star leaks out matter around a white dwarf, and the matter starts circulating around the white dwarf. This is pretty much dead and wouldn't do much for you if this extra matter from this normal star wasn't coming across. The extra matter permits an explosion, and we're about to see the explosion occur. What's the normal time which the seminars end? Okay. I won't do ordinary nova. I will bounce directly to the supernova. In the supernova, the material that comes off has gotten mixed with the material of the white dwarf, and the whole thing is liable and ready to go off in a huge explosion. But like other high explosives, it needs a really good push to get the nuclear detonation started. And it's hard to see where that push comes from. Further, if we just assume that the thing was detonated in its natural mixed-up state, maybe by lots of little explosions that somebody put in from outside, still the result of the explosion is poor because the outcome is mostly lighter elements and does not include the heavier elements actually observed in the explosion. My colleagues at the University of Chicago added two things to this. They suggested a new kind of trigger for this event. They said, let's take our beautiful big computer and use it to calculate when a hotspot appears off center in the star. Their beautiful, huge computer was capable of doing calculations in three dimensions. And if you recall the Rayleigh-Taylor picture with all the stuff, the dimensionality makes a difference. And in fact, the system can make, because it has instabilities that break symmetries, it can make use of extra dimensions. So here's this spot of hot material rising. It starts to go unstable because of the Rayleigh-Taylor instability and to get irregular in shape. It comes up to the surface and produces a shock wave. This was a new mechanism which made my friends very, very happy indeed. They, for a while, believed that this shock wave which came up to the surface would detonate the whole star and we would have a supernova which had been made at Chicago. Here's a picture of the actual simulation showing colors, I believe, and a very irregular object coming up. And here's the irregular object coming up shown in its full glory. We call that the jellyfish. However, this story was not to reach its climax here. The shock did not produce the immediate detonation, the big explosion that we were expecting. Instead, after the first few computer, after as many computer cycles as we could afford, it didn't do anything much. However, this is not the end of the story. One of the other workers on the project, Thomas Plua, suggested that another mechanism might work. The material might, oh, I have a picture for it when I show the picture. The material, the shockwave and the material it dragged along, might start out and move across the surface of the sun, of the star. Here is the bubble which rose. Here is the stuff coming off, which then gathers up matter which moves along the surface of the star. As it moves along, it comes down and skips and comes down and skips. And every time it comes down and comes up again, it dredges up additional matter. Until, well, the same thing happens, of course, on the other side. And since this is a three-dimensional object, it occurs around this way and into the board as well. Until at the end, there is an inertial focusing at the other side of the star. And at that other side of the star, everything goes boom. Computer calculations were done, two-dimensional calculations. We could not do the whole process three-dimensionally. Two-dimensional computer we is a funny representation, since they even less let me touch the computer than they let me touch the experiment. But okay. So this is what happens. And now we come to the end, in some sense. I have 5 minutes of conclusions. The star blows up. We have champagne. And then we ask about our accomplishments. Given that the mixing is an important part of this whole process, mixing that occurs when the material moves across the face of the star, dredging up other stuff, mixing which occurs when the bubble starts to rise, especially when the bubble starts to rise, this is not a result that you can say is a certainty, or in the language used in the U.S., a slam dunk. No, it is not a slam dunk. This is an argument, a suggestion. A prediction is too strong a word, a suggestion of what might be happening. So what can one hope to gain from simulations like these, in which some of the essential elements are untested and, indeed, with our present resources, untestable? Sometimes you can kill off wrong physical arguments with stuff like this. In our discussion of NOVA, in their discussion of NOVA that occurred in our labs and other labs that are around the country and the world, a mechanism for production of NOVA was discarded because it did not, after many simulations, a wide range of constants, seem to give the right NOVA kind of detonation. So arguments such as these as carried out can kill off wrong physical arguments. They can establish the range of variations needed to have crucial parameters so that the event will occur. Sometimes these explosions don't occur, and we sort of know a little bit when that will happen or won't. It can, and in the case I have described, it did suggest novel physical mechanisms for the event. It can discover unexpected behaviors and thus eliminate surprises. If you are an engineering laboratory, you do not want surprises. Whether you're engineering this or that or the next thing, you do not want surprises. You want your product to work as it is advertised to work. And sometimes you can see using simulations what the possible unexpected behaviors might be and work against them. And you can, with this kind of not fully checked simulation, start off programs for carefully checking suggested mechanisms. I point out to you this funny symbol up there. This funny symbol is the symbol of the bunch of people that I work for, the ASCII people. And these were the arguments that I gave for suggesting that these simulations, despite their inaccuracy in some starting elements, were nonetheless valuable. So what is the value of computer simulation? There is an important technical reason for the increasing use of computers in explaining and exploring physical systems. Past analysis of point particles, that is, if you want to calculate the Earth, Sun, Moon system, you might do that with ordinary differential equations, and you might do that with pencil and paper, as Gauss did. However, recent work is focused more on fluids and plasmas and solids that are studied as continuum systems, usually with the aid of partial differential equations. Partial differential equations have the property that they have all scales built into them, from the smallest to the largest. And as a result, you can have surprising results at a small scale or a large scale or an intermediate scale. You can have a wide range of surprising results. You can have structures produced that you didn't expect. We need methods to protect ourselves from being overtaken by unexpected occurrences. Computer simulations of these nonlinear systems can do that. But there's more to say. As soon as I look at the slide, I'll know. This kind of simulation that I talked about is an argument. A supernova might explode by doing this or that or the next thing. How do the power of arguments constructed in this way compare to the power of rhetorical arguments or order of magnitude discussions? Since the simulations must include everything to make the star go boom, they provide an internal check of consistency and completeness not available through words. That is, we know that we got the nuclear processes roughly right. At least they can produce explosions and non-explosions, both. Some intermediate steps in the argument may have their weaknesses hidden in unexamined computer processes. If the nuclear stuff, which I didn't talk about at all, had too simple a structure or the wrong structure, you wouldn't have found it out from me because I never looked at that structure. Computer arguments often force us to rely upon the integrity and care of the investigator. I was happy to do that. They were my colleagues, but it is also a little scary. So computers provide a useful but dangerous tool for the exploration of complex systems. But that's not all yet. But there are also major dangers in simulations. Often simulations are directly aimed at confirming our expectations, thereby throwing away the possibility of finding anything new. In addition, we must be careful to distinguish between simulations as arguments versus simulations as proofs. Bacall and company did a simulation as proof kind of thing. I showed you here a simulation as argument. There's a considerable risk of confounding the two approaches. It is tempting to say that computer simulations show when what is meant is more like recent investigations have raised the possibility that. In our writing, we are all tempted to replace "it would please us if" by "we know that." And if we scientists and engineers join up with all those around us in places high and low who confound possibility with proof and desire with truth, who will believe us in anything we say? I thank you.